And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, This was he of whom I said, He who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. The Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 14 and 15.
Dr. Stan here at the American Media Network. With us this morning is Bill Fetter, and we'll have Bill on in just a moment. But I want to share with you my very deep concern that we are heading into some sort of a foolish confrontation in the Ukraine. Remember, this whole thing came about because the United States spent $5 billion overthrowing the democratically elected government in the Ukraine. And Yukanovich, certainly the democratically elected president, was pro-communist. It was a pro-communist regime. But we overthrew him and replaced him with a group of fascists. And these are fascists, and they have swastikas, and they do the Nazi salute. Those are the people we've installed. And, of course, the people in the eastern part of Ukraine and the Crimea have traditionally been Russians, they're Russian-speaking, and they don't want to go along with the fascist regime. They're voting, I believe, this Sunday to separate from... And, of course, we're saying, oh, you can't do that sort of thing. You can't separate. Well, why can't they separate if they want to do it democratically? But they're looking for an excuse for a war. Why the Obama administration and Kerry and the trilateralists who are in charge, who are running the administration, want a war or confrontation now, I don't know. But if you saw what happened to the price of gold today, it was up $18, I think almost $13.85. Price of silver is up strongly. And we may very well be on the edge of some sort of a war. Make your preparations accordingly. Hope and pray that I am wrong. But understand, ladies and gentlemen, we intentionally precipitated this. The Russians didn't precipitate this. They controlled the Ukraine through Yukanovich. And, of course, it toppled a legitimate, democratically elected government, just like we toppled the democratically elected government in Libya and in Tunisia and in Egypt. And we're trying to topple the government there in Syria. We're put billions of dollars in to bring in professional terrorists who are killing the Christians in Syria. They're killing and raping and torturing them, and we're financing the terrorists that are doing that. And where is the outcry from the American people? I've yet to hear one caller call in who's been upset by what's going on. Well, if you're not, you should be. Well, with that as a background, our guest today is going to be talking on an entirely different subject. Bill Fetterer is an author. We carry a number of his books. Certainly one of my favorite guests. Good morning, Bill. What are we going to be talking about?
Well, Dr. Stan, great to be with you. And I thought I would give a little insight into St. Patrick, since St. Patrick's Day is coming up, and describe the world that he lived in that has some interesting similarities to the world that we live in.
Go right ahead.
Well, Patrick was a real person, and he was born around 389 A.D. or maybe up to 415 A.D., and so this is right after the Roman Empire had been Christian for about a century, and they had a situation of being invaded by illegal immigrants. Now, China had built the Great Wall of China. It was built over 1,000 years in different sections, but the Han Dynasty built a big section of the Great Wall of China, and this prevented the Huns. Some historians identify them as the Xianyu people, but this prevented the Huns from invading into China. And so they turned west, and it started a domino effect of tribes being displaced across Central Asia. So they would attack a tribe, and that tribe would be uprooted and would attack the next tribe west, and that would cause it to finally spill over the borders of Rome. And so Romans, in a sense, was being invaded by illegal immigrants. These were the Visigoths, Ostrogoths, Anglo-Saxons, Jutes, Lombards, a lot of our ancestors. And they first came slowly, and would learn the Latin language and assimilate. But then they began to come over so much in such large groups that they maintained their own culture and language, and this began to break up the unity of the Roman Empire. So they did mix in a little of the Latin, sort of a Tex-Mex mix. We call them romantic languages, not because they kissed, but because they mixed in a little Latin with their Anglo and turned into English, and then the, you know, the Germanic tribes mixed in a little bit, and the Frankish tribes. But then Rome had to put its military around the world to put out these global fires, so to speak. And the one, they had to raise taxes to pay for it all. And one historian said the tax collector was worse than the barbarians. And so Rome, Edward Gibbons pointed out, fell from the inside. They had a lot of immorality in Rome, lust, perversion. They had homosexual bathhouses. I went to school in Rome for 6 months in college. We would tour the ruins, and you'd go to they'd have the gymnasiums. And you think, well, what's wrong with a gymnasium? Well, gym, G-Y-M, is the Greek word for naked. And so a gymnasium was where a bunch of naked guys ran around, and they would have the jacuzzis, and under the floor, the slaves would stoke the fire to keep the jacuzzis bubbling. But Salvian was a 5th-century historian, and he wrote, "O Roman people, be ashamed of your lives. Almost no cities are free of evil dens or altogether free of impurities, except the cities where the barbarians have begun to live. Let no one think otherwise. The vices of our bad lives have alone conquered us." And Salvian goes on to say, "The Goths lie but are chaste. The Franks lie but are generous. The Saxons are savage in cruelty but admirable in chastity. What hope can there be for the Romans when the barbarians are more pure than they?" And then Rome had a practice of exposure of unwanted infants. The mother would bear the child and lay it at the father's feet. If he picked it up and thought it was healthy and thought they could afford it, they would keep the baby. But if he thought it was unhealthy or they didn't have enough money to pay for it, the mother would have to put the baby in a box and set it outside and let it be exposed to the elements and die. This was their version of abortion. And the early Christian writers condemned this practice. And they would write treatises and give speeches and condemn this exposure of unwanted infants. And if you read it, it sounds exactly like the preachers today that are condemning abortion. And Rome had violent entertainment. The people were just caught up, one historian said, in casual brutality of its public spectacles and rampant immorality that even Christianity could not check. So Christianity had been around for 100 years, but it didn't have enough.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Bill Federer. The similarity between Rome and America is striking. Okay, we'll go right ahead. For some reason or other, we don't have commercial breaks this morning, so Bill Federer, pick up the story.
Well, Dr. Stan, we're talking about the era in which St. Patrick lived, and I'm just giving a little background into Rome.
To describe what was happening in Rome, people misunderstand Rome became a totally corrupt society, and America has become a corrupt society. I mean, the world I was raised in was a moral society, and abortion was illegal, and the premarital sex was frowned upon, and we did not promote homosexuality, and we didn't start training our kids in sex in kindergarten. And yet America has become an immoral society. We've turned against God, and that's exactly what happened in ancient Rome in the period you're talking about. And I think we should learn the message of what happened to Rome, because when a nation turns against God, why God turns against that nation. Go right ahead.
Well, Rome was a republic for 500 years until Julius Caesar made himself dictator for life. Then it became an empire. They had immoral practices. Now, before Rome fell, Pompeii, there's even a movie coming out about Pompeii. Pompeii was the Las Vegas of the Roman Empire, and they if you've ever been through the ruins at Pompeii, they have murals on the wall of what the different prostitutes would do for you. And they would raise little children to be prostitutes from just, you know, preschool age, little girls, little boys. And so we're now doing that in our schools today. We're doing the same thing that Pompeii did. And, of course, the volcano erupted and buried the whole place in ash, and sort of have a testimony there of the judgment on the place. But Rome had sexual immorality, and they had violence. And so here's the scenario. The Roman emperor was getting news that his empire was being invaded and falling, and his army was having to be withdrawn and losing. Yet he didn't want the people in the city to find out about it and get upset and put him out of office, so to speak. And so the emperor would put on violent entertainment in the Colosseums, sort of a catharsis, sort of a, you know, and people would watch people being brutally killed. And, of course, Christians were thrown to the lions for 3 centuries. And but this was what they call bread in the circus maximus, these violent entertainments. Now, the whole city of Rome was on welfare. Instead of gathering together as in ancient republic times in the Roman town square, city square, and voting for their leaders and being a republic, now the people would gather in the city square and get a handout of grain, a dole of grain. They would get bought off. It was a welfare system, and so it was called bread and the circus. They would get free food and violent entertainment, and this would distract them from the fact their empire was crumbling, and the people became dependent on the government rather than controlling the government. They had a low value of human life. Matter of fact, Julius Caesar, when he conquered in Gaul, which is France, and in Eastern Europe, he brought back so many slaves. These were Eastern European people, and they were called Slavs, like Yugoslav, Czechoslav, Slovenia, and he brought them back into Rome and gave them away as permanent servants. And so the word Slav got the connotation of a permanent servant, and we pronounce that word today, slave. I thought this was interesting, lead poisoning. You know, we have the inner cities today, and the old apartments are painted with lead paint, and sometimes children would eat that lead paint. Well, in Rome, they had lead poisoning in the city, but it was because the pipes that brought the water into the city were made out of lead. Matter of fact, the Latin word for lead is plumb. So plumbing means leading. So the very word that we use for plumbing is lead, is the Latin word for lead. And so they had lead poisoning in the city. Some think maybe that's why Nero and some of these emperors were so schizophrenic, because they maybe had that lead poisoning. They had injustice in the legal system. Again, we're talking about almost 1,000 years worth of bureaucracy. I mean, we've got 200 some odd years of bureaucracy. Imagine 1,000 years. In Rome, the taxes became unbearable. One historian said, collectors became greedy functionaries in a bureaucracy so huge and corrupt. And then Salvian said the tax collector was worse than the enemy, worse than the barbarian. The Roman historian commented, those who live at the expense of public funds are more numerous than those who provide them. They had a trade deficit. This is interesting. Rome had outsourced all its grain production to North Africa. That was the nice fertile area, and the grain would be grown there and then shipped back into Rome and into Italy. When the Vandals, they were one of the tribes that overran Rome. You can imagine what they did when they went through town. They vandalized. That's where that word came from. But the Vandals conquered through Rome and through Spain and crossed the Strait of Gibraltar into North Africa, and they captured the grain fields. And when they held the grain back, the Roman Empire was brought to its knees. Sort of like today, we've outsourced our manufacturing to China. And if they ever held their ships back for just 3 months, all of our Walmart shelves would be empty, our retail industry would grind to a halt, and everyone would say, just give them Taiwan, just get our economy going again. And so Rome was vulnerable and brought to a shortage when the Vandals took over North Africa. one historian says, as conquerors of North Africa, the Vandals cut off the empire's grain supply at will. This created critical food shortages and in turn curtailed Roman counterattacks. And then the church, the one historian writes, the church, while preaching against abuses, contributed to the decline by discouraging good Christians from holding public office. So their version of separation of church and state was a hyper-pietism that at this time in the early 5th century, if you became a Christian, you were expected to give away your money and live in a cave or give away your money and live in a big stone building or build a platform in the desert and climb on top and bake in the sun, denying your flesh, thinking you were making yourself holier to God. But it was this intensely personal religion that withdrew people, Christians' effect on society from being a salt, so to speak, to keep the culture from declining. And so this was this withdrawal of Christians, you know, that the bars are bad and brothels are bad and theaters bad and government's bad. So you're not supposed to go and get involved in any of those things. That was the attitude. And that's another reason that Rome fell. And then Rome was, again, not just being invaded, but then Attila the Hun. He wiped out entire cities. He had an army of 500,000 people. Attila the Hun almost attacked Paris, and a young woman named Saint Genevieve got the whole city to fast and pray, and for no reason, Attila turned aside and spared the city. Attila was invading into Italy, and Pope Leo in 453 AD went out to meet Attila and talk him out of it, and the church history tradition is that Attila must have seen some angels in the sky above Pope Leo, and that's what turned him back. But nevertheless, it only bought Rome 20 years because the Visigoths finally did invade Rome, and they did sack it around 476 AD. Aquileia was a city in Italy that was the ninth largest city in Europe. Attila the Hun leveled it. He killed 75,000 people. The people ran out into the swampy marshes by the ocean and hammered platforms down with logs into the, you know, sandy muck. And then they would go on boats with long sticks from one platform to the other. And this grew into the city of Venice. So the city of Venice with its canals and gondolas, that started because of Attila the Hun wiping out. Anyway, and then again, I mentioned that the Roman language of Latin was displaced. And so at this time, this empire that was started in, you know, 500 BC and now it's 476 AD, it was falling. And so Rome had to pull its legions back from the frontiers to protect the city of Rome. And so Britain, which was a Roman colony in the far distant north, that is where Patrick lived. The word Patrick is Latin. It's patrician. It means a nobleman. The plebeians were the poor. And so we know that Patrick must have been from some well-off family, but you wake up one day and there's no police around, and that's what happened in Britain. They woke up and, gee, all the Roman legions were gone. And so everything was fine for a short time until marauding bands began to steal and kill and rape and kidnap. And so around this time, maybe around 415 AD, somewhere in there, Patrick was kidnapped and taken to Ireland, which was ruled by the Druids. And historian Mary Cagney writes, with no Roman army to protect them, Roman legions had long since deserted Britain to protect Rome from barbarian invasions. Patricus and his town were unprepared for attack. Warriors wearing helmets, armed spears, descended on the pebble beach with their braying war horns. And this is when Patrick was kidnapped. And then Patrick writes about this in his confession. And you think, well, what is that? Well, years later, after Patrick had been a missionary in Ireland for 30 years, there was some church politics, and the church leaders in Britain, now that they had sort of recovered from their attacks, they got jealous of Patrick and accused him of being an unbeliever when he was a young boy, and they wanted him to come back, leave Ireland and come back and have a little sit-down investigation talk. And church politics being as they are, Patrick refused. He said, God called me to Ireland. I'm going to stay here. And he wrote his confession and sent it. And so in his confession, he talks about, sure enough, when he was 15 years old, he didn't believe in God, even though his parents were Christian. And, you know, he confided that to a friend. And, you know, here they are years later wanting to bring it up. And then he goes through. So it's sort of like the Apostle Paul. If he had never been thrown in jail, he wouldn't have written all those letters of the New Testament. And so Patrick, if they had never accused him, he never would have written down his life full of spirits that constantly needed to be appeased. This is called animism. It's the most basic pagan religion, you know, from the tribal Africa to the American Indians to, you know, the Japanese neighborhood gods that, you know, there's these spirits that needed to be appeased all the time. And in Ireland, they appeased it with human sacrifice. And so there are these bogs in Ireland that just even fairly recently they've uncovered, you know, bodies that have had their hands tied behind their back, and they were shoved in this, you know, mucky bog as a appeasement. And Thomas Cahill, author of How the Irish Saved Civilization, writes about the Druids sacrificed prisoners of war to the war gods, sacrificed newborns to the harvest god. They believed the human head was the seat of the soul, and so they displayed the heads of their enemies on their temples and palisades, you know, on the wooden, you know, telephone poles, like around their fortresses, they would stick heads. The Druids would take shrunken heads and hang them from their belts. They would use skulls for goblets and even kick around an enemy's head like a football in a victory celebration after a battle. And so the Druids were where Halloween came from. And the woods being filled full of spirits, well, that started to come down to us as elves and leprechauns. But nevertheless, Patrick wrote in his confession, he says, after I came to Ireland, every day I had to tend sheep. Many times a day I prayed. The love of God, his fear came over me more and more. And my faith was strengthened. And my spirit was moved so that in a single day I would say as many as 100 prayers and almost as many at night in the woods, the mountains. I would pray before daylight through snow, frost, rain. I felt no harm. The spirit within me was fervent. He writes about, and the Lord opened the sense of my unbelief that I might at last remember my sins and be converted with all my heart to the Lord my God, who had regard for my abjection and mercy on my youth and ignorance and watched over me as a father would a son. And so at this time, he basically remembers the faith, the Christian faith of his parents, and he gets saved, so to speak, and he begins to have the Lord speak to him in his heart. He calls it an inner monition, and then in dreams. And so in his confession, he writes this, and there one night I heard in my sleep a voice saying to me, it is well that you fast. Soon you will go to your own country. And again, after a short while, I heard a voice saying, see, your ship is ready. But it was not near. It was a distance of 200 miles, but I'd never been there. And he said, I took flight, left the man I had been with, and with the strength of the Lord, came to the coast. And sure enough, he found the ship. And there was some hunters that had rounded up some wolfhounds in Ireland and were taking them back to Britain to sell them as hunting dogs. And so Patrick said, the day I arrived at the ship, set afloat, and I was not able to pay for the passage. The captain was not pleased, but he basically said if the dogs would mind him, then he could come along, and the dogs did. They get shipwrecked in Gaul, which is southern France, and they're going for, Patrick writes, and for 28 days we traveled through deserted country, lacked food and hunger, and the captain said, tell me, Christian, you say your God is great and all-powerful. Why then do you not pray for us, seeing we are suffering a hunger? And Patrick said, I said to them in full confidence, be truly converted with all your heart to the Lord my God. Nothing is impossible for him. And then he says right after that, suddenly a herd of pigs appeared on the road before our eyes. They killed many of them. We stopped for two nights and recovered our strength. Then Patrick's afraid that this group is going to make him a slave.
Hold that thought. Don't know whether we're going to have an ad here, but we'll go to the break and then we'll see what happens. We're not, they're having problems there at the studio, so we're just going to go ahead and pretend that they're we're through the ad. Go right ahead.
Well, we're going through the story of Patrick and that he was a real person and lived in the 400s, which we call the 5th century, and he had been kidnapped and was a slave in Ireland for 6 years. The Lord tells him in a dream how to escape. The boat that he's on gets shipwrecked in Gaul, southern France. And he says they're traveling for 28 days and starving. And the leader of the group tells Patrick to pray, and he does. And a herd of pigs goes across. And then Patrick says this, that he was afraid that this group was going to make him a slave. And he said, once again, after many years, I fell into captivity. On the first night I stayed with them, I heard a divine message saying to me, 2 months you will be with them. And so it came to pass on the 60th night thereafter, the Lord delivered me out of their hands. And then he spent years in Europe. He goes back to Britain and is reunited with what's left of his family. And he's possibly spent some time in France at Cannes, in the ministry, possibly St. Honorat, an island off the French Riviera, studying under a St. Germanus. These are claims that are there, but they're hard to substantiate. But he did make it back to Britain, and he writes in his confession, "And again, after a few years, I was in Britain with my people, who received me as their son and sincerely besought me that now at last, having suffered so many hardships, I should not leave them and go elsewhere." So he's there till he's around 40 years old. And Patrick said he has another dream. He writes, "In the depth of the night, I saw a man named Victoricus coming as if from Ireland with innumerable letters. And he gave one of these to me, and I read the heading, which ran The Cry of the Irish. And while I was reading out the beginning of the letter, I thought at that very moment, I heard the voice of those who were beside the wood of Falkirk near the Western Sea crying out, 'Please, holy boy, come and walk among us again.' Their cry pierced my very heart. I could read no more, so I awoke." Well, Patrick took this as a divine call to go back to Ireland as a missionary. If you remember, the Apostle Paul was thinking of going to Asia, and he gets a dream of somebody in Macedonia saying, "Come over here." And so this dream convinces Patrick to be a missionary to Ireland. And Ire is the old Celtic word for green, because it was very moist, a lot of fog, and so very green. And so Patrick decided to leave again, takes a band full of guys, and they go over to Ireland, maybe around 431 A.D. Scholars debate the date. But he goes over there, and he boldly goes into the smoky dens of the Druid chieftains. I mean, this would be like you and I going to a downtown big city and, you know, going to some drug dealer and say, "Take us to your drug lord," you know, and usher you in with all their guns and all the, you know, the drugs. And so they, Patrick, you know, has them take him into the den of this Druid chieftain. And he begins to proclaim the gospel to him in their own language, which he had learned as a slave. Now, as soon as it became clear that he was preaching a new religion, the Druids wanted to kill Patrick. The Druids were the religious pagan element, and then the chieftains were the ones ruling. And so the chieftain was not in a hurry to kill Patrick. He said how they don't get visitors that often, and he speaks their language. He's sort of an interesting guy, and what's the hurry to kill him? He's unarmed. And so the chieftain would give Patrick a plot of land, which Patrick built his first church on, and the chieftain ended up converting. And there were about 30 chieftains across Northern Ireland, and Patrick had a top-down style of evangelism. He would boldly confront the top guy, and if he converted, then his whole tribe would convert. And, of course, the Druids tried to kill him. Patrick writes, over a dozen different times, you know, they would try to kidnap him and lay ambush for him and try to trap him and so forth. And but one famous story is the contest at Tara, T-A-R-A. It was a flat area with a hill rising above the plain. And this chieftain, King Longere, or King Leary, would have everyone in his little kingdom extinguish their fires and bring a gift, a goat or a cow, to him and the Druids, and they would get coals to relight their fire for the next year. And whoever didn't extinguish their fire on this particular night of the year would be killed. And so people are all gathering there, and Patrick goes to the highest hill and lights a bonfire. And according to the 7th century historian Marucci, he writes that Patrick challenged the Druids to a contest at Tara. The custom was that whoever lit a fire before the king on that night of the year, which happened to be the night before Easter, would be put to death. Patrick lit a paschal fire on the hill of Slain, and the fire was seen throughout the plain. The king ordered 27 chariots to go up and seize Patrick, and seeing the impious heathen were about to attack him, Patrick rose and clearly said, "May God come and scatter his enemies." And by this disaster caused by Patrick's curse in the king's presence, 7 times 7 men fell, and the king, driven by fear, came on bent knee before the holy man. Sort of brings up images of Elijah praying on a mountaintop and Ahab sending up, you know, 50 men to get him, and they're struck down. Anyway, this gives you a idea of the stories passed down about Patrick. Another was a druid invoked a cloud, a fog that was so thick you couldn't see in front of your face. And Patrick said, well, cause the fog to disperse. The druid was unable. Patrick prays, and suddenly the fog clears and the sun shines. And then it says, and through the prayers of Patrick, the flames of fire consumed the druid. Now, I don't know what that was all about, but it says the king was greatly enraged at Patrick because of the death of his druid. Patrick said to the king, if you do not believe now, you will die on the spot for the wrath of God descends on your head. And the king summoned his council and said, it's better for me to believe than die. And so he believed with many others. Sort of, again, brings images of that demon-possessed girl following Paul around, and then he casts the demon out of her, and the owner of the girl gets all upset. But these are the stories that have been passed down. 12 different times Patrick faced life-threatening situations. He writes in his confession, regardless of danger, I must make known the gift of God and everlasting consolation. He says, I came to Ireland to preach the gospel and to suffer insults from unbelievers. I am prepared to give even my life without hesitation. He says, even so, they tried to lay hands on me and my companions, and on that day they eagerly wished to kill me, but my time had not yet come, and everything that they found with us they took away and put me in irons. And on the 14th day, the Lord delivered me out of their power. Daily I expect murder, fraud, captivity, or whatever it may be. I fear none of these things because of the promises of heaven. Cast thy thoughts upon God, and he shall sustain thee. Little different image than the little leprechaun clicking his heels. I mean, he was a very bold, courageous man. Even Encyclopedia Britannica said he found Ireland heathen and left it Christian. Now, Patrick had an inferiority complex. What do I mean? He writes in his confession how he was kidnapped before he finished his education. And so he was always bothered by this. He says, Patrick the sinner, an unlearned man to be sure. I had long had it in mind to write, but up to now I have hesitated. I was afraid lest I should fall under the judgment of men's tongues because I am not as well read as others. As a youth, nay, almost as a boy, not able to speak, I was taken captive. Hence today I blush exceedingly and fear to reveal my lack of education, for I am unable to tell my story to those versed in the art of concise writing in such a way, I mean, as my spirit and mind long to do, so that the sense of my words expresses what I feel. Another letter called the Epistle to Coroticus, Patrick writes, I, Patrick, a sinner, very badly educated. And so the reason I think this is interesting is because you and I may always have thought in the back of our mind, I'm not prepared enough. I'm not smart enough. I don't think, I can't debate this person or that person. And we can't let that hold us back from attempting to do great things for the Lord, just like Patrick didn't let his feeling of not having been educated because he was kidnapped as a boy hold him back. And then the other thought is that because Patrick didn't write in deep theological treatise type of, you know, works, he talked in the language of the common people. And, for example, he used the three-leaf clover to teach the Trinity, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, three in one. And so he was able to communicate. And so what he viewed as a handicap actually made him more effective in communicating with the common man. Just a fascinating history of a person. Patrick was considered the first abolitionist. What do I mean? Well, Patrick was kidnapped, right? And he was taken and sold as a slave in Ireland. Well, he had evangelized. He baptized 120,000 people in 30 years. Again, you know, found Ireland heathen, left it Christian. But there were other chieftains in Britain that were capturing Irish and selling them into slavery, and they were capturing Irish that Patrick had brought to the Christian faith. And so Patrick, you know, writes letters condemning these people, saying that they're taking the bride of Christ and making her into a harlot. And so the church cries out and laments for its sons and daughters. And he calls that chieftain wicked, horrible, unutterable evil. But,
well, that's awesome. Well, that's awesome. I don't know if we're going to a break or not, but anyway, we'll stop just a moment and then be back here at the
Are we still going here?
We are going. Go right ahead.
Okay, super. Thank you, Dr. Stan. Again, this is all in a book that I wrote. It's called St. Patrick, The Real Story of His Amazing Life from Tragedy to Triumph. And then I have a three-half-hour program DVD where I go through the fall of the Roman Empire and the story of Patrick. So they're all available at AmericanMinute.com is my website.
Tell people how to get to your website. How to get your material.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. My website, again, is AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. And the title of the book is St. Patrick, The Real Story of His Amazing Life from Tragedy to Triumph, and then a DVD by the same title. And it's 3 half-hour programs. I also have a toll-free number, 888-USA-WORD, 888-USA-WORD. And we're actually running a special if you get the book and the DVD now for only $25. But slavery, Irish. Patrick was a slave. Patrick condemns this one chieftain, Caroticus, who was capturing Irish and enslaving them. But did you know that in the 1600s, more Irish were sold into slavery than Africans? That's right. Ireland was Catholic. Spain was Catholic. And for a short time, they were going to team up and invade Britain, which Henry VIII had made Anglican, had broken it away from the Catholic Church. And Mary, the daughter of Henry VIII, we call her Bloody Mary because she killed about 300 Protestant leaders. She was Catholic, and she wanted to bring England back under the Catholic Church. Mary's gone, and there's Queen Elizabeth, and then you got, you know, Oliver Cromwell, and so they invade, the British invade Ireland and kill about 300,000 people. The Spanish leave, thanks a lot, they leave, and so about 500,000 Irish are rounded up and sold into slavery. They're sold in the Caribbean, to Barbados, Bermuda, Jamaica. They're sold to the colonies in America, and they were treated really bad. Matter of fact, the 1700s and 1800s is when the Africans were enslaved, but the 1600s, it was the Irish. And so the African was the expensive slave. They were the Cadillac of slaves. I mean, they could work in the hot weather and you know, bring it, they were more productive. The Irish, you could buy them real cheap. There was the very vehement Protestant Catholic hatred that went on at that time. And then later, there was an Irish potato famine. And millions of Irish Catholics come to America. Millions die over there. There was the Catholic percentage during colonial America was 2%. 3 million people, only 20,000 or so Catholics. Catholics were only allowed in three colonies, New York, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. And even in those, they didn't have full rights. Matter of fact, Pennsylvania had the first English-speaking Catholic church in the world after the Reformation. The Catholic percentage in America went from 2% to 20% in just a decade in the 1840s and 50s because of this Irish potato famine. And so they would call the Irish the black, they would the white, and then they would say the N-word. they would say that the Irish is white on the outside and black on the inside. and so people would put up signs, no Irish need apply, and they would just have to spread out across the country to get jobs. And so that's why so much of America has Irish populations, because they were not allowed to stay up in the New England area and the New York, Boston, Philadelphia area. Anyway, Irish love parades. And over in Ireland, the Catholics would parade through the Protestant neighborhoods, and the Protestants would parade through the Catholic neighborhoods, and they would usually end in a fight. In America, they had their first parade in the early middle 1800s, and the politicians, the Democrat politicians, saw, 15,000 Irish marching through the streets. And they got up to 50% of New York City. That's how many. And the Irish had not gotten involved in politics yet. In Ireland, as part of the British Empire, it didn't matter their numbers. They were not allowed to vote. They were not allowed to participate in politics. It wasn't until Daniel O'Connell, who actually was the champion for rights for Catholics, that in the late 1800s finally got rights for Catholics so they could vote. But in America, these Irish, when they had their parade, Democrat politicians started marching in the parades with them. And so they realized their numbers meant political clout, and they were able to rise in being respected through rising up the political ladder. And then you had the working hard and pooling money and then becoming successful financially, many different entrepreneurs and so forth. But it's a fascinating history that we often forget. But Patrick, again, was a real person. Now, this is interesting. If I have another minute or two.
Yes, you do. Go right ahead. We've got another 3 or 4 minutes.
Patrick started 300 churches. They were very independent. Again, at his time, Rome was being attacked by Attila the Hun. The last thing the Roman church leadership cared about was the outback of this little island in the end of the world. So Patrick was pretty much independent on his own, and he started these churches, but they were also starting communities, and they would build a stone wall around their little, village, so to speak, and they'd have a tower in the middle with a door about 20, 30 feet up and a long ladder. And if the marauding bands or Vikings attacked, they would ring a bell. Everybody would run up the ladder into the tower. They'd pull the ladder up behind them, and they just waited out. And the Vikings would just, pillage and steal and kill and, what was left. And then after they all left, they'd put the ladder back down, and they would climb down the tower and rebuild their little community. And so Patrick's started these churches and these communities. But what's interesting is the next century, it was those churches that Patrick started that sent missionaries back to Britain and back to Europe to evangelize those heathen hordes that had overrun the Roman Empire. So it sort of went full circle. Because of the heathen hordes invading Rome, Roman legions were pulled back and left Britain unprotected, so Patrick got kidnapped. But because Patrick got kidnapped, taken to Ireland, and then evangelized in Ireland, it was the next century that the Irish missionaries went back and sort of reseeded Europe with the gospel, and these heathen hordes eventually got converted. One Irish missionary was named Columbus, and then a generation after him was another Irish missionary named Columbanus. Columbus meant dove, and Columbanus. Columbanus started over 100 monasteries and churches across Europe, even into northern Italy in the 500s. And so just a fascinating story of how it went full circle. Now, those communities that Patrick started in Ireland, now that they weren't Druid anymore, they thought, well, what do we do for laws? Because we're not following the Druid, human sacrifice laws. And so Patrick wrote the Code of Patrick, mixed in some of the Irish laws that could be salvaged, mixed in some Latin laws and the Bible laws. And so this is called the Code of Patrick. And so when the Irish missionaries went to Iona, a little island, and then from there they hop, skipped, and jumped to Britain, and then they evangelized in Britain. They took the Code of Patrick with them, and in the 800s, it was Alfred the Great, the young guy that helped to keep the Vikings out of Britain. Alfred the Great codified English law, including the Code of Patrick in there. And then Alfred the Great's law, which gave rights to people, the Vikings took over England for a while. William the Norman, the Norse Normans were the Vikings. He was a Christian Norman, William the Conqueror, but he had this chieftain Viking top-down type of government. But the British would always refer back to Alfred the Great, always refer back to the Code of Patrick, of these rights that they had that were given to them by God. And so we call this English common law, and it eventually affected American law.
Well, we're going to a break, and we'll be back in just a moment here, one way or another.
Should a natural or man-made disaster hit, do you have the will, the skill, and the gear? Gear up with Preparedness Gear, a full-service store located at I-25 and Highway 52, exit 235, just south of McDonald's. We have your survival needs. Long-term storage, food, water filtration, bulk grains, bug-out bags, survival equipment, and a comprehensive selection of educational books. Visit us online at preparednessgear.com for upcoming classes or call us toll-free at 888-981-9810. That's 888-981-9810. Get your gear on! Great Plains Power has been providing reliable electrical power systems in the Rocky Mountain area since 1992. Our systems rely on the sun to help make you self-reliant for your power needs. Solar energy can be scaled to fit any situation, from complete power independence to backup power for the short term. Our expertise focuses on standalone power, but we have extensive experience with utility interactive systems as well. Custom tailored capabilities as modest as emergency lighting all the way to commercial scale power. Great Plains Power is a full service company. We service everything we sell. We provide and design turnkey packages, custom design system, and parts for do-it-yourself. With more than 20 years of specialized experience at your disposal, let us know what your power concerns or goals are. Reach us by phone or the internet. Call 303-239-9963. That's 303-239-9963. Or go to greatplainssolar.com.
No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque or reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility. Article 1, Section 10.
And Bill, are you still there?
Yes, yes.
Why don't you go ahead and get your telephone number out one more time, your webpage, so people can get in touch with you, and then we'll let you go.
Well, thank you so much. My website is AmericanMinute.com, and AmericanMinute.com, and toll-free number is 888-USA-WORD, 888-USA-WORD. The title of the book is St. Patrick, The Real Story of His Amazing Life to Tragedy and Triumph, and then a DVD that has 3 half-hour programs where I go through the fall of the Roman Empire and the life of Patrick. And anyway, just a fascinating story that encourages us that at a time when a civilization is crumbling, being overrun from the outside and immorality on the inside, the good Lord was able to touch one person and have him be courageous enough to proclaim the gospel, and here we are 1,600 years later still talking about him. Imagine what you and I would have to do to have a day for people to celebrate us a millennium in the future. Just an amazing person, and his story needs to be told. And just thank you for having me on, Dr. Stan.
And you do a wonderful job. I've heard this story before, and I always love it. God bless you. Thanks so much.
God bless you.
Later, Bill. Okay, fine. Well, that was Bill Federer, and let me close by saying, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know whether this war is going to amount to anything, but understand, ladies and gentlemen, all of the wars are contrived, and if one comes now, it is contrived. We, United States foreign policy, toppled the government of the Ukraine and brought the fascist government to power. And understand, we worked closely with Putin exactly as we worked with Hitler during World War II, and that's why they let him escape at the end of the Second World War. Hitler did escape. You haven't heard our four CDs yet. Did Hitler escape? You need to get it. Certainly, we have several books on this. We have other tape sets on this whole situation, how we financed the Nazis, specifically America's Nazi Secret, America's Nazi Secret by John Loftus, The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler by Tony Skousen, and then, of course, The Power Elite and the Secret Nazi Plan by Dennis Cuddy. And then, of course, we do have the four CD set on Operation Paperclip, and that's how we helped the Nazis escape to South America, brought them here. The War Against the Jews, my interviews with John Loftus, where he goes into the background of how we financed the Nazis before, during, and during the Second World War. Then it was the Standard Oil. It was providing the oil for the Nazi U-boats that were sinking our ships, but you're never going to hear this thing through regular channels. The last thing they want you to understand is that all the wars are contrived. As far as how did they get us into the first Gulf War? Well, we had that terrible terrorist attack on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Ladies and gentlemen, you look at the pictures of the Pentagon. The hole was about 18 feet wide, 15 feet high. I mean, how do you get a plane into something like that? You don't. We don't even know what happened to the plane. Barbara Olson was on the plane. She was a friend. We had her on repeatedly, and of course, that plane disappeared, just like 007, certainly Korean Flight 007 with Larry McDonald. We know what happened to Congressman McDonald. He was taken to prison in Russia. We actually talked to people who were in touch with the people who were in the cell next to him. And we have a 4-CD set on what happened to Larry McDonald.
You're listening to The Lion, 10,000 watts, KHNC, 1360 AM, Johnstown, Denver.